Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We will have class next week. We won't have class on Monday night next week. It's the 4th, but we will have class Tuesday night, the 5th, here. We are on page 130, and we'll try to get up to page 135. Doesn't sound like a lot of pages, but it's going to be a lot of history. We're going to break into two parts. They're going to be the years 1250, which is right after the end of the Crusades, if you want, in a real general sense. The Crusades are just wrapping up. Up until 1517. Now, 1517 is where we make a break from the Egyptian dynasty, Mamluk Caliphate, or that's where the power was at. And I remember at different times Muslims are fighting if it's going to be the Iraqi Muslims against the Egyptian or from the Syrians or the Turkish. In this case right here, it's going to be the Egyptians are going to rule from 1250 to 1517. Then the power is going to go to the Caliphate of the Ottoman or Asia Minor. We call it Turkey today. That's where the power base is going to be at. And of course, it's so interesting, ironic, or typical. That's where the news is today. It's right here. I mean, nothing has changed in the sense we've expanded in the Western world, but yet right back here is still that hub, which is still the Ottoman Empire. Do not take your eye off the fact that when Daniel talks about the head of gold, the chest of silver, the waist of bronze, the legs of iron and clay, which most people would assume is the Roman Empire, starting with Babylon, Persia, Greece, the Roman Empire. Then you got the two legs that end in iron and clay. The Ottoman Empire, or that part of Turkey, Syria, Turkey, was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. It was conquered by the Persians. It was controlled, and the Greeks moved in and took it. Rome moved in and took it. And it's been that place. The Christianity moved up into there. And this is right here, southern Turkey, Syria, right? There's where Antioch is. We talked last night about Antioch, Paul coming out of Antioch, going to Cyprus with the missionary trip. His missionary trips, 1, 2, and 3, are all through Turkey. They're all through the Ottoman Empire, which is, again, part of the Babylonian Empire, part of the Persian Empire, part of all. And it's that hub right there. And then we read in Ezekiel about Gog and Magog coming from the north. That is the area, or part of the area, that is included in that. So when you think about the fourth beast is different than the others. It arises, you know, out of the sea. And we start talking about Daniel's prophecy tying into Revelation. It appears this is, and again, I'll deal with that later in the book, this is what is unique about it. And what's taking place in the European community with the breaking apart and all the discussion over there. In the 70s, as you know, in the 80s, it's like, wow, this could be revised Roman Empire. It could be the beast, the fourth beast of Daniel. And again, you know, we all look at that. I taught that. I embraced that. But when you start looking at it from this perspective, it's almost like, oh my gosh, that's not the revised. Europe is not the revised Roman Empire. Europe is what Europe was. The revised Roman Empire, or Daniel's prophecy, it never moved. It was Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. Christianity moved up into it, and all the way through, once Christianity fell, the Muslims, and including from 1517 to 1918, World War I ended the Ottoman Empire as we know it. And it became Turkey, the young Turks, they got more of a democracy. That's why we had so much travel. Linda's been through this area. We were able to travel in Turkey. You could see things. It was a democracy. We had, we're somewhat unified with them because the young Turks revolted against the traditional Muslim ways and kind of brought in some kind of democracy. Well, that's unraveling as you read the news today. You know, Constantinople, which is, we're talking about Constantinople in these years. We're talking about Constantinople or Istanbul. During all of these years, today it's back. And you can see this is potentially what's happening now, what fell in 1918. And that is why, for me, maybe for you also, some of these things are new information. But when you look back at history, I'm like, what was I thinking? Why wasn't I aware of these things? Because this is the distant past. My grandfather fought in World War I. World War I kind of ended that, opened up the void. Now, what we do know, universally as a group, we know this, that in 1948, Israel comes back as a nation. There's the War of 67, the War of 73. Israel's there today, an ally of the United States. It's like, oh, Israel's back. But the reason Israel is back is because after 1918, a vacuum was left in the Middle East, where the Ottoman Empire that had controlled it had built the walls of the present city of Jerusalem. We'll talk about that. That is still there today. Suleiman the Magnificent. All that power created a vacuum. Great Britain moved in, helped establish Israel. World War II took place. Israel comes back into the land. And we just forget. I just forgot, or I was never exposed to this. I never paid attention to it. I can't blame anybody. I know some of these terms sound familiar from high school classes or college classes, but it's just ancient history that made no sense to me. I didn't care about it. I didn't understand American history a lot of times. But now when you look back, it's like, oh my goodness, 1918, World War I, just put a stop to it, created a vacuum. Israel's back in the land, and now this thing is heated back up. Now we've got the Western world, you've got Israel in the land, and you're right back in the same hot spot that was Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, early Christianity, the Muslims all the way up until 1918. It's always been Muslim territory since Christianity fell. It's just now ISIS is marching through it, the terrorists. Where this is going to go, I don't know, but it sure seems to me it's on some kind of a schedule. Again, just like we used to think the European common community, that whole thing was on schedule. But nonetheless, I just ramble right there saying what I'm going to show you tonight is history. But it's interesting how it's history that just continues right up into your face right now today as far as all the things that are taking place. So let's begin page 130. Let's begin on page 133. So we've got a map so that you can be referring to this map. I try to get all the places, especially in the years on page 133, every place that's mentioned during the years 15, 17 to 1918, I try to get some kind of reference on that map so you can at least see it taking place. But what you should notice, first of all, just notice Turkey, Anatolia, that's that area there. That's going to be the Ottoman Empire or the headquarters of the Ottoman Empire. And then notice all where Egypt is at, down towards the south, the Nile River. That is the area where this Mamluk caliphate was powerful. So that's still Muslim territory, even during these years. It's just not the driving force. Then, of course, you go further to the east, over into the Arabian Peninsula and the Euphrates, Tigris area. That's Muslim territory. What we're looking at here, when you get to the year 1570, 1918, is we're looking at Turkey being the Ottoman Empire or the Ottoman Caliphate after they overthrow the Mamluk Caliphate in Egypt. The Ottoman Caliphate, or becomes the Ottoman Empire, is going to be doing a variety of things. It's going to include driving Europe or Europeans or the Holy Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church, and the countries that are supported by the Roman Catholic Church. You know, the Pope appointed the emperors or the kings over those nations and controlled it. Then in 1517, Martin Luther throws a wrench in the whole thing, the Protestant Reformation. But all those countries there are going to have conflict with the Ottoman Empire. And I like to point out the fact, all the way through these notes, the Ottoman Empire is Muslims. They're following Islam. They're following the Quran. You can call them the Ottoman Empire, and it sounds, you make it sound whatever you want. It's the Ottoman Caliphate following the teachings of Allah in the Quran and the Hadith. But notice these places. You can see, starting in the Mediterranean Sea, Cyprus. And there's a couple cities that are mentioned there. They're going to be overrun by Islam, driving out the Europeans. Rhodes is mentioned. These are biblical places. Crete. All these are biblical places. Titus was on the island of Crete when Paul wrote to him the book of Titus. Then you come up into Athens. Athens is going to fall. Greece is going to be challenged and invaded by Islam or the Ottoman Empire. The Dardanelles, that's the spot right there that when you cross that, you are up into Europe. And the only thing that's where Alexander crossed from Greece to come in and conquer and created the Greek Empire when he conquered the Persians. The Muslims are also going to cross there, and they're going to be having activity in Bulgaria, where I'm going north up in there. They're going to have activity. All those little cities, some of them are large cities. Hungary, and then the cities surrounding that. They're going to make their way up into Poland. They're going to declare jihad on Poland. Now, again, jihad is something we're just familiar with recently, but they were declaring jihad on nations back during the Ottoman Empire. They're going to have trouble in the Ukraine. They're going to be up in the land of Russia. And so all those places that we're going to mention are marked on that map. So you can see between 1517, 1923, and the dates 1918, 1923, you've got the end of World War I. You've got the dissolving of the Ottoman Empire. You've got the dissolving of the Caliphate. All those are happening in like a train wreck. It begins in 1918 when World War I ends, and they've got to come in and democratically dissolve the caliphate. They've got to dissolve this, rise up the land of Turkey with their young Turks having some kind of a democracy. The dates 1918, 1923 is kind of the end of the Ottoman Empire. A lot of it's just paperwork ending it. A big year for Israel is going to be 1921. 1918, 1921, all those years are big to Israel, almost bigger than 1948. 1948 is when they came back, but the rise of Israel into the land began as the Ottoman Empire is being set aside. Israel's making progress in the land. They're buying land. They've got people that, they got the whole Zionist movement. And all this is just interesting information, and it's hard to grab a political side on it, because sometimes you find yourself cheering against your own opinion as you watch history unravel or unfold. Anyway, there's that map. So let's go back to page 130 and read through the Egyptian caliphate or the Mamluk caliphate just real quickly. Here's what they're doing. What we're trying to do, and we spent several weeks doing this, is we're trying to just establish the direction of Islam. They're not just living in the Arabian Peninsula, being oppressed by the Western world. That didn't even really last very long, more than a generation. And they're already, in the first generation, they're already attacking Christianity, Byzantine Empire. They're talking about taking Constantinople or Istanbul right away. They call it the Byzantine Empire. And again, that's the Roman Empire in the Christian form. So right from the get-go, Islam was against the Byzantine Empire. So in 1354, and again, the Crusades have come and gone, and you can make your own opinion about the Crusades. I don't like the Crusades. When you look back at it, the Crusades were, what else are you going to do? Islam is invading Rome. They're trying to take Europe. They were stopped, and the kings have to unite somehow to drive Islam out of Europe back in 1000 B.C. They've got to go back and save Jerusalem from just being terrorized and destroyed by Islam. They're destroying the churches, the holy sites, including the tomb of Jesus Christ. They crushed it. And that's where the church is saying, wait, we're going to be eliminated from history unless we stand up and fight. Well, Christians don't fight. Well, if they hadn't fought in that day, and maybe they shouldn't have, it's hard to justify it, but if the Crusades hadn't happened and drove Islam back, they may have just kept right on coming. In fact, I can almost say they would have just kept coming, because why would they stop? There's nothing in their theory, their ideology to say, well, this is enough. This is the Western world. This is our world. We'll live peacefully. They're going to conquer the world. Just like I believe Jesus Christ is going to come back, like that rock that was not cut out by human hands, and strike the bottom of the statue and become a kingdom that covers the entire planet. I believe Jesus Christ will rule the entire planet. I'm waiting for that day. Islam believes they are going to conquer the entire planet. They may have setbacks, but eventually they will control the planet and you will submit to Allah. That is what they believe. There's no place in their doctrine where the Christians live on the western side, we live on the eastern side, and the transgenders live in the middle. That's not in anybody's doctrine. The only reason they're letting us live here in the Western world today is because they can't figure out yet how to get rid of us. And I'm not being judgmental. You can judge me. The only reason Islam is still a living factor here on the earth is Jesus Christ hasn't come back. Because when he comes back, he's going to end Islam. Again, say, well, that's not very Christ-like. Well, read the book. I mean, Jesus comes back and destroys anything that is not in his kingdom and establishes a kingdom that will never come to pass, never pass away. So that is bare-bone Christianity in Islam. The difference is I'm not going to establish the kingdom of God today. I'm waiting for Jesus. I'm going to proclaim his lordship today to this fallen world and give you a chance to enter the kingdom that's coming. You may kill me in doing it. Their idea, Islam's idea, is we're going to kill you and make our kingdom come. And that's the basic difference. Now, again, there's the variations of people trying to fit it all together, even in churches today. Well, it's all going to work out. It's not going to work out until Jesus comes back and fixes it. Okay, 1354, the Muslims, the Ottoman Turks, conquered the Christian Byzantine fortress at Gallipoli on a peninsula on the European side of the Aegean Sea. It's a big deal because now they're on the other side of the Aegean Sea, on the European side. They've crossed over into Europe and have conquered it, not coming up just from Spain into France, but now they're coming right in through into Greece. This now opens up the opportunity for Muslim advance north into Serbia and Hungary. So now once they're on the peninsula of Greece, they can move north with their troops. 1375, Muslim Mamluks, that's this dynasty here, the dynasty of the Egyptian caliphate, take Sis, the capital city of Armenia. Now that's going to be more to the east in Turkey, bringing an end to the Armenian independence. 1382, Muslim Turks conquer the European city of Sofia, Bulgaria in the Balkans. 1453, here it is. Muslim Turks capture Constantinople and kill the Christian emperor Constantine. This ends the Roman Empire in the east. Now, I know it goes without saying, but you all saw the news right here. Muslim Turks capture Constantinople, driving Christianity out of that city in 1453. Today, they're there, some form of it is there, tearing up the airport. Again, what is that, or that means? It just means, well, it's the same town, same types of issues. 1456, Muslims capture Athens, Greece, the seat of philosophy, if we remember it that way. Muslims capture Bosnia in 1463. 1467, Muslims conquer the land of Herzegovina, which is the southern portion of Bosnia, so they're up into Bosnia. Muslims invade Croatia, which is the land north of Bosnia in Europe, so now they're north of Bosnia. Muslims invade Dalmatia, which is the coastal land west of Bosnia, to the west of Bosnia. 1499, Muslims defeat the military fleet in Venice. The city surrenders to the Sultan. Again, that's their leader, that's their government official, the Sultan. Again, they're going to the west. In 1501, they've got problems back in Persia, so they reverse, go back into the east, reconquer Persia. Muslim Sultan of Turkey attacks Persia. 1515, the Sultan of Turkey conquers eastern Anatolia and Kurdistan. Salim, now this is important, Salim the First, that's going to be an ancestor. He's going to set the stage for Suleiman the Magnificent, which is a very interesting person. Salim the First defeats Egyptian forces near Aleppo and annexes Syria to the Ottoman Turks. So this is the falling of this right here. You can see the pressure from the Ottoman Empire or the Turkish Muslims putting pressure on the Egyptian caliphate, and they've now got Syria. They go on in 1517. The Muslim Turks conquer Cairo. 1517, again, this is Muslim versus Muslim. 1517, Mecca surrenders to Salim the First. So now the Arabian Peninsula, see, the Turks or the Ottoman Empire has taken Syria. They bring it into their kingdom of Turkey or the Ottoman Empire. They conquer Cairo. Now, this caliphate has fallen. Egypt is part of the Ottoman Empire. They move on and they take the Arabian Peninsula. So now a big chunk of this Egyptian caliphate, the Mamluk caliphate, is now part of the Muslims in the Ottoman Empire, or a new caliph has arisen. And that's in 1517. Now this sets the stage for, again, that is, the stage is set now. This has fallen. Whatever they controlled has been conquered by the Ottoman Empire, by Salim the First. And in 1520, now we're moving into this Ottoman Empire. Here's the first ruler of what is called the Ottoman Empire, or the Ottoman Caliphate. Suleiman the Magnificent succeeds his father, Sultan Selim I, as the Sultan and Caliph of the Ottoman Empire in Turkey. And this is going to go from 1517 or 1520 up until the end of World War I. World War I will end what starts right here. Suleiman the Magnificent was magnificent. He was a great leader, a great politician. He's the one who built, if you go to Jerusalem and you look at the walls of the old city Jerusalem, you walk through the Jaffa Gate, you walk through the Damascus Gate, he built those. It was his instructions to build those walls. Suleiman. In fact, over on the Lion's Gate, there's an inscription. In fact, that's why the lions are there. The lion was a symbol of the Sultan. They're on there, and it's got his name inscribed in the wall, and it got the year that it was done in the Muslim year. He is the one who did this. There is, again, this is just information you don't care about necessarily, and you get more about it in the Jerusalem book when you talk about, I describe the walls and the gates of the city. Suleiman originally wanted Mount Zion included in the wall. Now, again, I don't want to bore you with this, but if you look, you can look at the back of your Bibles, or you know, you can see the wall today. The wall goes up the Damascus Gate on the north, comes over to the Joppa Gate over here, kind of comes around here, comes down to the Dung Gate, the Lion Gate, and this part right here, which is Mount Zion, today it's called Mount Zion, is not inside the walls. Here's the Joppa Gate, Damascus Gate. You've got the Lion Gate here. You've got the block Eastern Gate right here. Dung Gate, Zion Gate is right here. But originally, the architects were supposed to put everything that was holy inside these walls, including the city of David that is outside the walls. But they couldn't get cooperation from these people to help pay for the wall. So they basically said, you don't get protection. Forget it. We're not going to build a wall. You don't help pay, we don't build. And they cut them off. That's what the architects did. No taxes, no protection. When we get in, again, they're right off the tails of the Crusades. Or people are still fighting in the Crusade style. You know, that's why you've got the gates with the little porches out. There's a name for them that starts with an M. I've got it in the Jerusalem book, but where they could pour hot water down the wall or oil as you're attacking. Because people would attack the gates, and that's where they'd pour stuff. They're like, especially the Damascus Gate. If you look at a picture of the Damascus Gate, it's a killing field is what it is. It's designed to slaughter people. It's magnificent, but it's designed, when you attack this, we're going to kill you right here. It's just got enforcement and places to shoot from. It's a killing field right here. The gates were designed as killing field centers. Nonetheless, when they did include these people and the architects said, you're not going to help pay, we're not going to build. Suleiman then took those, there's two of them, two of the architects, and we found out he came to visit. He says, why is this not in the city? They weren't willing to cooperate. He was mad. Suleiman the Magnificent was mad, and he executed the two architects, cut their heads off. And when you go in the Joppa Gate today, you go in, it's an L-shaped gate, because if they ever broke through, this is an easy gate to break through, like right here. And they've changed some of the gate, like the Zion Gate, or like over here, the Lion's Gate has been changed. You can see the renovations. Today it's a straight shot in. But that's the last way you design a wall at this time, because once you broke in, if you had an L shape, you'd have to get all your troops in, everybody turn left, and then come in. And it bought you another 10, 15 minutes. Because all of they can't, in here you just rush in and spread out. In here you got to rush in, turn, and then rush in. And it's enough time to reassemble your troops, and you got one last stand and kill them as they're coming through the gate. Well, anyway, if you go in the Joppa Gate, which is still an L-shaped gate, you enter and turn, right here, and I've got a picture in my book, the Jerusalem book, is two tombs, two little. Because they followed his directions and they'd done a good job, not the way he wanted it, but he felt he needed to honor them. He had them decapitated because you didn't do it the right way, but I will honor you. And they're buried right here. You can go in there and walk, because you look right here, you walk in and go, two tombs. And you walk by them. So that's interesting. You can see those right there. They're buried right there, the guys that failed us. That's Suleiman the Magnificent. And that's just one of the many, and who's he protecting it from? Well, he's protecting it from the Egyptian Muslims. He's protecting it from the Iraqi Muslims. He's protecting it from the Christians. That's his city. Okay, that's 1520. I think he built that right around 1517. Interesting, while this is going on, you know what's happening up in Germany. Martin Luther and the printing press is being invented. So you talk about a technology explosion and trouble in the Middle East. That was 1517. The printing press, we can print stuff like that. And we got two or three copies in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. And you thought the internet was fast. This printing press was amazing, the movable print. Martin Luther is rebelling against the Catholic Church. It's like, you can't rebel against the church. They'll send you to purgatory. Unless you don't believe in purgatory, then who cares? It's like, so Martin Luther's, he's free. He doesn't even care about the Pope. And the Pope, you know, sent him the papal bull, a declaration of, you've been excommunicated from the church. You know what Martin Luther did? He excommunicated the Pope and burned his document. Here's your document from the Pope. You've been sent to hell. It's like, he goes, well, guess what? I sent him to hell and burned it up, had a big little party out there around in Germany. And everybody thought, that's pretty cool. Anyway, that's not how people were used to treating the Pope. People weren't used to having things printed off quickly. And Suleiman is reinforcing Jerusalem. That's 1517. 1521, Suleiman conquers Belgrade. Now, what we're interested in here is, again, the Muslim advance and pressure on Europe. They're in Belgrade, which is the largest city in Serbia. So they take Belgrade in Serbia. Suleiman begins to invade Hungary. Suleiman takes Rhodes from the Knights of St. John. Muslim jihad against India. Now we're going back to the east. They're declaring jihad on India. Suleiman signs a 7-year truce. Now, don't you think that had the end-time prophets or end-time teachers going crazy? Suleiman, this magnificent, signs a 7-year truce with the king of Hungary. Ah, this could be it, you know. Yeah. Muslims conquer Hungary in the Battle of Mohács, killing King Louis II. Suleiman takes control of Budapest, the largest city in Hungary. Now, please, did you notice that? 1925, Suleiman signs a 7-year truce with the king of Hungary. The next year, he conquers Hungary. So, there you go. Don't worry about our treaty with Iran. I'm sure it's going to be fine. I mean, just history just tells you something's wrong with this. It's like, well, we got to trust. I really believe that whatever, I don't care who's signing the treaty, there's something wrong with signing treaties with these people. Well, you just got to have more faith in humanity. Or you need to read the Bible and understand you can't trust humanity. Even John says Jesus didn't trust humanity. John was the most distrustful. You read it. John the Apostle was the most distrusting person of human nature in the Scriptures, other than maybe Isaiah or Jeremiah. He didn't like human nature. He didn't like people. It's like, oh, the Apostle love. It's like, yeah, except you read the last couple of books, he's saying, no, don't go there. Don't trust them. Why? Because Jesus taught it. It's like, you can't trust people. They look honest. They're not honest. They're people. They're trying to do what's right for themselves right now. Well, nonetheless, that's preaching now. 1526, Muslims become the preeminent power in Central and Eastern Europe. I'll read that again. 1526, Muslims become the preeminent power in Central and Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe, we're talking about the Ukraine. We're talking about over in Russia. And in the center, you know, Hungary, moving up into Poland. 1529, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire attack Austria and plunder Vienna. Suleiman I takes Budapest and annexes Hungary to the Ottoman Empire. Just like he annexed the Arabian Peninsula and Syria, he now annexes Hungary to the Ottoman Empire. It's advancing. That's why they call it the Ottoman Empire. It's not just Turkey or the Ottoman little place they live here. It's like he's conquering. He's messing in India, Persia, Arabia, Egypt. He's already got Turkey, and he's moving in. He's gone across into Greece, and he's moving up into Europe. 1571. Oh, what did I missed a bunch of stuff there. 1546, Muslims occupy Moldova, which borders on the Ukraine. 1560, ships of the Ottoman Empire rout the Spanish fleet. 1560, again, notice that, ships of the Ottoman Empire. You see, they're not riding camels, folks. They're using ships, and they're defeating the Spanish fleet. The perspective of it, these guys are just riding around on camels. They're sailing wherever they want to go. They're invading where they want to go. The Ottoman Empire declares Muslims plunder the city of Nicosia on Cyprus. Ottoman Empire declares war on Venice. 1571, Pope Pius V signs an alliance with Spain and Venice to fight the Ottoman Empire. So now you've got the Pope coming along with Spain and Venice saying, we have to get our countries together and unite against the Ottoman Empire. I mean, it's almost like a new crusade. 1571, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire conquered the city of Famagusta on the eastern coast of Cyprus. And what do they do with the people? They kill them all. 1594, Muslims conquer Rab, a market town on the Austro-Hungarian border. So they're up there on the border again. 1596, Muslims defeat the imperial army at Kurezdetes in northern Hungary. North, they've gone from the border to northern Hungary. Ottoman Empire invades Hungary again in 1613, 1620. Muslims of the Ottoman Empire defeat the Polish army, which at the largest city in the east in eastern Romania. 1645 to 1669, Muslims are at war with the Republic of Venice and her allies, which are Malta, the Roman Catholic Papal States, France, all fighting over Crete. The Ottoman Empire conquers and secures Crete in 1569. 1563, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire declare war on the Holy Roman Empire. So in 1663, the Muslims declare war again on the Christian Empire, or the Catholic State. They invade Transylvania and Hungary and conquer the fortress Nové Zámky in Slovakia. 1671, Muslims declare war on Poland. Now, does that sound like something you've ever heard in head, that the Muslims are declaring war on Poland? That is 1671. That's a long time ago. 1683, jihad is proclaimed on Vienna, and Vienna is captured by July. 1690, Muslims reconquer Belgrade. 1711, Ottoman Empire is at war with Russia. 1736 to 1739, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire are at war with Russia again. 1738, they take Orsova, a port city on the Danube River in southwest Romania, and drive the Russian imperial troops back into Belgrade. 1739, they approach Belgrade, and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI agrees to sign a peace treaty. So he says, okay, we need a peace treaty to get this thing resolved. 1739, you understand what's taking place in the Western world in 1739. We've got America is being founded, formed. 1809, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire agree to a treaty with Britain called the Treaty of Dardanelles. And you know where that's at? It's at that spot there between kind of where Istanbul is and going up into Greece. It's where, again, the great passing of Alexander the Great, when he crossed from the Dardanelles, he's in Asia attacking the Persian Empire, and he never came back. But they are signing, Muslims in 1809 are signing a peace treaty with Britain concerning that area. Because, well, which ends the Anglo-Turkish War, Britain received the commercial and legal privileges in the Ottoman Empire, and the United Kingdom promised the Ottoman Empire protection from the French who threatened them. So if Britain basically says, if you'll allow us to pass through that seaport for our trade advantage, we'll protect you from the French who are trying to fight back. So now you've got two European nations at odds with the Ottoman Empire. It's at this time, if you go back and you can look it up, and I don't know a lot about it, I just know I've read about it a little bit, is the same thing. America was having trouble with trade in this area, probably in the same conflict, because of the Muslim, what they called pirates, in the Mediterranean. We couldn't sail trade ships through that area because the Muslims would invade and take the stuff. And so Thomas Jefferson hired people to fight their way through it and fight the Muslim pirates. Thomas Jefferson was fighting Muslims on ships in the Mediterranean Sea in his day because he was trying to trade for America through those waters. And here again, this is the way Britain resolved it with a peace treaty with them. We'll help fight against the French and keep them off your back if you'll let us trade. And Thomas Jefferson had his own way of dealing with it. 1822, the Ottoman Empire captures the Greek island of Chios with their fleet of ships in the Aegean Sea and massacres the inhabitants. The Greeks respond by setting fire to the Muslim admiral's vessel. So the Muslims then invade Greece. The Muslims seize the Greek island of Ipsair, but they are defeated. The Muslims of the Ottoman Empire enter Athens in 1827. 1827, the Caliph Mohammed II of the Ottoman Empire, obviously Suleiman the Magnificent, is gone. He rejects the right of the allies to mediate in their invasion of Greece. And the allies are going to be some of the European powers that want to negotiate for Greece. He says, we're not talking to anybody, we're invading Greece. In 1841, the five great powers, and the great five great powers in 1841 were Russia, Prussia, Austria, France, and Great Britain, guarantee the sovereignty of the Ottoman Empire. So the five great powers of Europe, finally in 1841, look at the Ottoman Empire and say, we will recognize you as an independent nation. 1869, the Ottoman Empire gives Greece an ultimatum to leave Crete, which Greece accepts. In other words, since they're their own nation, they say, well, we want this island of Crete. And you can see the island of Crete. It really belongs to Greece, but the Ottomans, they say, it really belongs to us. Greece says, okay, we don't want any trouble, and they let them have it. In 1883, the beginning of Islam's 14th century, so it'd be the 1300s in Islamic years, produced the Muslims' conquest of Sudan by a Mahdi born in East Sudan. So in 1883, we move down back into Sudan or down into Africa again, and there's a Mahdi supposedly born there, and he begins to rise up. And whenever you have a messianic figure or a Mahdi-type person arising, things are going to start to get heated up. And that's their way their theology is built. In 1885, the Sudanese Mahdi takes Khartoum, the largest city in Sudan. The British general, see, all this is controlled by Britain. You know, they're the kingdom, that the empire that the sun never set on. It's collapsing, begins collapsing, you know, with America's revolt and on in here. Their general is killed in the fighting, and the British evacuate Sudan. And again, you know all that, but that's why when you talk to someone like Nigeria or Ghana or some of these places, they can talk English. They've got a huge accent. Sometimes it's got a British accent, but it's because they were occupied by Britain back in the 1800s and for many years. And so they may have their own language, but they also can speak English. I never take phone calls from that area because I used to get a lot of phone calls, but I can never understand. They're speaking English, but it's such a, you know, I can hardly understand someone from Texas, let alone speaking English with the King's English from Nigeria. And it's I say email me because it's easier to read an email, and even then you've got the King's English in there. But anyway, Britain was all, but they're backing off because Muslims are taking the area from them. 1885, the Sudanese, okay, 1909, now you see we're getting close to World War I. The Caliph Abdul Hamid II is deposed by the Young Turks. Now this is, again, we rushed through history, right? See, we rushed 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. Now it's 1909, and the Ottoman Empire, the old school Muslim empire, is having some trouble with this group called the Young Turks. You've heard of them before, possibly. And you can see the little hats, little round hats with the little, what are they called? There's a name for them, with a little string on them. It's almost like what the Shriners wear. It's something like that. Yes, that's it. I believe that's what this has come. That's where this comes from. The Young Turks were a political reform movement that favored replacing the absolute monarchy, that's the caliph, of the Ottoman Empire with a constitutional monarchy. A little different. You see that? And that's going to cause, you got old school, new school, 1909. And so you got the Young Turks rising up, which is going to set the stage for World War I, and it was going to end up creating that vacuum that's going to produce Israel in the 1900s, which puts us right where we're at today with everything's. This Ottoman Empire that is beginning to dissolve here, in 1909, there's a desire to replace it with something different. And then World War I up to 1923, that Ottoman Empire was the crown jewel. Now, understand this. I don't know much about it until I started studying it. I'm not sure how much you knew about it. But that was the crown jewel of Islam. That was one of their glory years. I mean, look, they're up into Europe. They're controlling a large portion of the world, Muslims, in their empire under their caliphate. When that passes away, it's like, well, that's over. In the Muslim mind, it was an embarrassment. In the Muslim mind, they're going to rebuild it. They're going to rebuild this empire. And so however they describe it, however it's written, however it's presented, this empire has been set back by the Western powers, World War I, then World War II, and then Britain helps us, and the United Nations helps establish Israel, that they can't get rid of. They want this empire in some form with a caliphate to arise again to get this thing going. And it's been going for 1,400 years, and they need this to come back. So when you talk about the beast that was, that is not, and comes back again, we can talk about all that again. Now, I think that's talking about the Roman Empire at that time. But part of that can all fit into this of, it could even, some people even say, was wounded in the head, but then came back. Now, I think that sometimes I think that's an individual, and it can be a double prophecy. You know what I'm saying? There's double prophecies. For example, Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, Daniel said what to Nebuchadnezzar? You are that head of gold. But the head of gold wasn't just Nebuchadnezzar. The head of gold was what? The Babylonian Empire. So you see, even in, as Daniel's interpreting it, he says, and after you will come another kingdom, not as glorious, or it's not as great. So in one sentence, he's saying, you are that head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. By the time he's done with the prophecy, Nebuchadnezzar's empire is the head of gold. So when you start talking in the book of Revelation about a head being wounded, or the fatal wound, and then recovering, yeah, it could be an individual. In fact, I lean towards that. But it can also have a double meaning of an empire that is destroyed, and yet comes again. And this is exactly, like I said, that's exactly the map that is on the Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, early Christianity. It is the same places where Gog and Magog come out of. It fits. I'm not, I can't slam dunk this. I'm just saying this isn't too far off of whatever the end time is all comes down. It's going to be something that sounds like this. Is this it? I don't know. But it's going to sound something very similar to this. Okay. 1909, you got the Young Turks, and the Young Turks, which are Muslim, they deposed the Caliph Abdul Hamid II. So they basically got rid of the position of Suleiman the Magnificent, got rid of that position, says, let's replace it with a constitutional monarchy. You've got political chaos happening at that time. 1912, Muslims of the Ottoman Empire closed the Dardanelles to shipping. 1912, so that's going to upset the trade in the air. It's going to upset the economy. It's going to upset all around the European world. It's going to cause economic problems in 1912. You can see war coming. You need to see a treaty, a resolution, an invasion, or some kind of the whole world is watching this. 1914, November 14th, the Muslim cleric in Constantinople, Istanbul. The Muslim cleric in Constantinople, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, declares jihad, calling Muslims from all around the world to attack. Lone wolf attacks? I don't know. Attack Britain, Russia, France, Serbia, Montenegro. Now, do you see what's going on right there? They're calling. They're not saying our army is going to attack this country. They're saying all of your armies, if you've got an army, if you've got any kind of power, go attack these places. Do you understand the difference? When America declares war, America sends their troops here, whatever. But when the Muslims declare war, it's like calling the Christians to war. Whatever church, whatever country, you figure out your own, get yourselves organized and go start attacking these places. I mean, it sounds similar to what you see today when ISIS would declare we need to attack whatever. It's like, where's the army coming from? From the Muslims. Where are the Muslims? We're everywhere. And you've got to figure out how you're going to do it by yourself. You're going to do it in a little group. You're going to have a little army come over from some country. How are you going to do it? When they call the Muslims to jihad, figure out how you're going to do it. They're not going to have like a little training session over here and then they send their military. America's going to have their training session and then they send their military to represent it. For example, I can't go to war against Canada. I can't have a lone... I'm attacking Canada as a lone wolf. It's like, and that's, they say, what's that? I mean, that's what we call terrorism. But in Muslim or in Islam, a lone wolf or a small group, some vigilante force, there you go. And that's what they're doing right here. That 1914 Muslim cleric in Constantinople, used to be the head of Christianity in the Byzantine Empire, declares jihad and calling Muslims from all around the world. Again, what authority does he have? He's a cleric. He's a pastor. He's a preacher. He's some kind of a seminary graduate in Islam. You know what I'm saying? He's not got any political power except his religious background. It's like Billy Graham calling Christians, you know, start attacking Islam wherever you're at. Right. Mm-hmm. Right, because remember they were signing treaties with the Holy Roman Empire, or they were an empire, and they were recognized by the great powers of Europe as an independent nation or their own government, and we can talk with them, have negotiations with them. But then when a cleric starts declaring war or jihad, again, yeah, the word you can play with right there is war or jihad. You can go to war. America can go to war. And then there's certain rules on war. But when the church would declare jihad, we're just going to start killing, you know, a group of people. Well, that's no longer controlled by the government. That's a holy war. That's a religious war. So yeah, the Ottoman Empire, under the guise of a nation, was declaring war. But now, because of the demise of the Ottoman Empire, they're collapsing. What's left is now just the clerics to keep this going. So yeah, there is... there's a difference. Right. Because they could take control of something, and now there's a government now, just like America could invade someplace, and now we take control of it, we set up our government, and we control it, we have certain rules. But a jihad, a holy war, is a little different. And the rules are different. And the rewards are different. Meaning, you know... Okay. Okay, I have heard about, I have, now that you put those numbers out like that, yes, I know nothing about it, but I have. Right. That might be where I read it. Because they said that someone came up and explained to him how they took care. That might be how it. Right. And they were, yes. Yep. Yep. Yeah, we don't recognize them as Christians. We call them Armenians, but they were Christians from the first century, from the very earliest days. Yeah. Which all of a sudden, this is an ancient history anymore. My grandpa fought this war. I've got his medals in my room. I mean, he was here in this war, and so. Right, yeah. And it's not necessarily the fault of the Western world's prosperity that caused Muslims to behave this way. Meaning, I mean, you can blame it how... Politically, you can get up and dance around this all you want to. But the Republicans and the Democrats and the borders and the United States has nothing to do with... I mean, I just mentioned Thomas Jefferson here, and he's got to fight pirates when he's trying to establish a nation. He's fighting Muslim pirates, and that's... So Just in things to put in perspective. Thank you. That's interesting. Okay, so then that leads to right here. They've called jihad on many of the powers of the Western world. 1914, World War I begins. Russia and Britain declare war on the Ottoman Empire. 1918, of course, there's volumes can be written there. 1918, after 4 centuries of ruling the Middle East and threatening Europe, Africa, the Orient, the Muslim Ottoman Empire, collapses. creating a vacuum in the Middle East that is still unsettled today. And that is true. Israel's there, but it is still unsettled. And it's unsettled on purpose. It's unsettled for a political... There's people don't want it settled. I mean, for example, if you went in there, you could just fix it. But there's people there that don't want it settled. They want Israel gone, and they want this rebuilt. And Israel doesn't want it settled and just pack up and go somewhere, go to New Zealand or something. They want to stay in the land. So they're not going to just let it get settled and put up a border. Okay. Islam does not consider this issue over the verdict of World War I, the war to end all wars, final. It's like, well, it's over. It's like, well, it's been set back. But they're on full advance again right now. They're full throttle. Now, again, just catches up. So I jump from 1918 to 1979 in the book. The beginning of the Islam's 15th century in 1979. Mecca is the site of a messianic insurrection in 1979, affecting the entire Muslim world. And you got them kind of fired back up. It's the beginning of the 15th century of their life, or their history. A messianic movement begins. This event forces Islamic apocalyptic thinking. We're going to begin talking about that here in the next few chapters. They just like we talk about end times or apocalyptic, how does the world end? They have got their own scenario, and we'll get in some detail on it. And I'm going to be able to show you how it parallels Christianity's end times. But they began thinking, and it began to sweep through their communities about this, stirring this up, getting this apocalyptic thinking going. Supporters of the self-proclaimed Saudi Mahdi seized the great mosque. So now you've got down in Saudi Arabia, you're going to have a new Mahdi is going to rise, and he's going to see his followers are going to seize the great mosque in Mecca, and is only stopped by a violent military response. Also, the Soviet Union's invasion. Now you think Bin Laden is all this is there. This is in the background. All the Bin Laden family and money with Russia and the weapons. Reagan's in this. You know, at some point Reagan's going to get in on this. Again, not saying good or bad, but it's like it's on his desk. He's dealing with this. Well, here I write this here. The Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan that followed. Fans these apocalyptic flames, meaning Russia invades, as you see, here comes the Russians, here comes the Western world, and gives rise to leaders like Osama bin Laden. In Muslim history and geography, the Russians are the Khorasans, spoken of in medieval legend and apocalyptic literature. We could spend a lot of time on this. These are the people that are behind the wall that finally in the final days invade, which is an indication that end days are breaking out. So when Russia comes down, it's like us seeing Gog and Magog coming down into Jerusalem. They see a group of people coming down. And once you see Gog and Magog coming, say, oh, we're in the end times. They see Russia coming. It's like, boom, this is what we're talking about. Fight to your death. And this is an internet. And with this, an international jihad begins. Now, did I know there's an international jihad that had begun in the 1980s? Through the 1980s. I mean, I was oblivious to it. And it's embarrassing for me to say it. It wasn't until this next date, 2001, that I'm like, what? September 11th. It's like, well, where are all these people? What is going on? And then all of a sudden you look, it's like this little crack in the wall. You look through that little hole and you see, oh my gosh, there's 1,400 years of history. Why did we not see this coming? There's, you know, just this wall of ignorance for me that I was looking at my own little world. And this thing's been coming at us for 1,400 years. In 2003, the United States invades Iraq. 2005, the new Iranian president claims to be shrouded in the light of the hidden imam. And that's someone that we're going to be talking about. As he speaks to the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York. And the hidden imam is the Mahdi, whose revealing has been 1,300 years in the making. And he's going to come. He's like the Messiah-like figure. And he was shrouded in his glory and his light as he spoke to the United Nations. And they put up with it. I mean, they're listening to this. They won't put up with Jesus Christ, but they'll put up with this. So all of a sudden, the book of Revelation begins to make sense, or potential, of all how religious it is and how religious the world is, talking about God and all these things. in it's not the secular humanists that are the problem in the book of Revelation. It's a religious group, a worldwide religious group that is bent on terrorizing Christians and conquering the world. He says that as he spoke, he sensed the luminous radiance of the soon to appear hidden imam surrounding him like a halo. Have Donald Trump say, as he's speaking during a message next week, that he felt the presence of Jesus Christ surrounding him as he's preparing to return to the earth and establish his kingdom. Watch the polls turn. It's like, but this guy right here, everyone's like, ooh. Of course, he challenged politically after 2009 Iranian elections for voting fraud. He resolved the conflict by neutralizing his opposition with military force. When he didn't win, he just killed him and, oh, I did win. Okay, so what we begin on page 134 is, I try and wrap this up somehow. Yeah, we got a little bit of time. Basically, I write this here. The preceding list of 1,300 years of Islamic expansion to the east, the south, and the west, and north is undeniable. What I've tried to present is they started in the Middle East, and they've been expanding from the get-go. And you can go back and look at it. Even that first generation took the Arabian Peninsula, and they just kept on going. And they just haven't gotten in all the way to England yet. Or have they crossed the Atlantic Ocean yet? Or have they? But that's where their goal is. And it's been going on for 1,300 years. When honestly responding to the previous 1,300 years of world conquest, I write, the Muslims' religious views of history, government, society, and globalization are declared justified under the umbrella of the concept of jihad, found in verses in the Quran and the Hadith. We'll talk about that next week. What is the Quran? What are the Hadiths? And here's one right out of the Quran. Here is a Bible verse from the Quran, or a Quran verse. But when the forbidden months are past, then fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, and seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war, meaning every layer of war, not just on the battlefield, but in economics, in education, in politics, every stratagem of war. I mean, if you're going to be a good warrior in a modern world, you're going to have to do more than just drop bombs on people. You're going to have to infiltrate every level. That's jihad. This is in the Quran. But if they repent and establish regular prayers and practice regular charity, then open the way for them, for Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful. So, after they invade every layer of your society, if you'll repent and come to Allah, they'll accept you. If not, they'll have to kill you. According to the Concise Encyclopedia of Islam, the concept of jihad is summed up as a, quote, a divine institution of warfare to extend Islam into the Dar el-Harb, or the non-Islamic territories, which are described as the abode of struggle or of disbelief. Now, you can say that's their inner soul struggling. Sure, I'm sure they have their own dark areas of their own soul to struggle with. But this is context, is the dark areas of the pagans in conquering their territory. If all Muslims were to dedicate their lives fully to their face great commission, it is not yet known or yet revealed what would happen. Got a little statement there from Understanding the Times, which is interesting. While there are many opinions within the global Islam regarding the definition of jihad, the first thing Islam is going to do, the first thing they're going, I mean, it's not even, it's a no-brainer. When you say, well, there, it's a jihad, a war, it's a holy war to kill us or have us convert. Oh, no, let's explain what jihad really means. It's a struggle of our soul, really. Oh, yes, we're struggling just like you. That's jihad, okay? That's lying. That's redefining things to stay in every stratagem. You don't go to your enemy and say, here's our battle plans. I want to be a good, honest warrior. Here's our strategy how to defeat you. You don't even do that in a basketball game. You shake hands with the other coach. And when you shake hands with the other coach before the basketball game, you don't say, we're going to run a full court press the first half. We're going to fall back into the zone. And at the end, we're going to jump back into the full court press and break the rhythm and win the game. Look for it. You're not going to tell the coach that before the game. You shake his hand. You say, good luck. And you go to war. What is Islam going to do? They're going to say, yes, jihad, we are here to kill everyone unless you convert. If we get into your political office, we're going to start killing people until that is our goal, until you can come to Allah. It's like, Oh, no, no, good luck. We're just having a fun game here. We're struggling just like you're struggling. Let me tell you what I'm struggling with. I'm struggling to present the message of the kingdom of Jesus Christ until he returns. When he returns, he's going to lay waste all the unbelievers and the wicked that are on the earth and establish his kingdom. I hope you're on his side. Good luck. I mean, there's no like, well, when he comes back, then he'll have a time where he'll share the gospel, maybe have some school set. He's going to come back with a sword coming out of his mouth, and the flesh will melt on them when he returns. Oh, dude, that's so cruel. That's the book of Zechariah. That's the book of Revelation. That's Paul's writings in Thessalonians. That's throughout the scriptures. That's Jesus' own words. Well, how I think you've taken them out of context. You understand? I mean, if you want to believe jihad means a struggle of their soul, they're just here killing people as they struggle with their finding the right way, it's typical of our society. Believe the lie. God says that. Paul says that he's going to send a lie. He continues. God allows lies to come so that those who have rejected the truth, this is what I want to believe. Here's the truth. I don't want the truth. Well, here's something else. Oh, that's what I want to believe. Go your way. Go to your destruction. God lets you believe a lie because you've rejected the truth. Page 135, as history shows, whenever an Islamic apocalyptic revolution succeeds, the emerging Messiah figure survives a social upheaval to found a new dynasty. In most cases, those who identified and instigated the apocalyptic movement soon become disillusioned, and their new Messiah and the Mahdi or great Iman, and they revolt against him also. So it continues back and forth like that. And that's kind of where we're going. The last comment I've got is right out of a book called The Crisis of Islamic Civilization. You can read about some things right there. Again, that's not my opinion. It's somebody else's opinion. It kind of supports what we're saying. And on page 136, we begin this next week. We're going to talk about the Quran. A little again, this is just introducing some concepts. And then we're going to talk about the Hadith. And basically, the Quran is the writings of Muhammad. The Hadiths are the sayings that Muhammad said that were never written down until the next generation or the following generation, when people started asking his wives, what did Muhammad say? Well, Muhammad said this, and they'd write it down. And they'd talk about his friends, what did Muhammad say? And they, as Muhammad always used to say, you know, and then they'd write it down. They got volumes of these, so many of them, that they're contradicting each other, and we'll talk about that, till finally they had some scribes sit down and say, okay, let's fix this. What are the true sayings of Muhammad? They've got his Quran, but what were the hadiths? And so they threw some of them out, says, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. And they came up with the accepted hadith. The hadith, if you say it this way, again, this is a sloppy way of saying it. The Quran is, in a sense, the sayings or the writings of Jesus. It's the Gospels. Again, which is bad, that's not the case. The hadith are the things that the apostles wrote, and they wrote many, many books, but we've got to figure out which ones are the true epistles. And we've got the canon. That's not what happened exactly in Christianity. But we do realize, even Luke says, many have undertaken to write down the Gospels or the things that happened among us. And Luke went through and researched and got you the things that Jesus said. So they're purifying the thing. The Quran is what Muhammad wrote, but he was illiterate. Don't judge. It was a miracle. And that's part of their apologetics. It's, well, I thought he was illiterate. Well, that's part of the miracle. Okay? That makes it even more supernatural. And again, that's a whole debate if he was illiterate or not. And one of the things, we'll talk about it next week. Anyway, we'll talk about what the Quran is and the Hadiths. And that's kind of like the basis of where we're going to be going with this. And what do they believe about Jesus? What do they believe about end times? And eventually we're working this into the church today. Us is, we're in shaky water ourselves as far as the church knowing the truth. And if we want to continue to believe a lie about Islam, Islam's going to roll right in, and our fake, false ideology as a church is going to embrace Islam as a brother in God or whatever. And they're going to go, great, we're looking for dummies. And they're just going to roll right over us. And that's going to lead to, potentially, it matches the book of Revelation, where all of a sudden, what we thought was peace is, you know, they've been at war with us before we knew there were religious wars. They were killing Christians before the Protestant Reformation. They were killing Christians when the Pope was still trying to figure out what he's going to do with the barbarians. Okay, I'll quit, and we'll get into that next week. Eventually, we're getting into some things I think are a little more biblical, but that's just some history to kind of help prove what I'm going to say in the second half of the book. I'll pray, and if you have any questions or comments, please feel free. Father, we thank you again for your truth. We thank you for the chance to look into these things. I do know that we're looking at history and recording of events, and Father, we do ask that for your hand to be with us as we evaluate these things. We don't want to twist them and make them fit what we want to see, but Father, we do want to find the truth and walk in the truth and be prepared for the events that we'll find in our own lives. And we thank you again for this chance to meet in our country. We thank you for the freedoms that we have, and we ask that we would not squander our freedoms, but actually use them to advance your coming kingdom. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Any thoughts or concerns besides running class on for another 2 hours because this was a non-ending subject? Everybody's okay? All right. Thank you for being here.